Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode 29. This is your host, Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to everyone who's been here for a long time, and welcome to those new listeners. We have so many new listeners. Wow. I mean, the subscribership has just skyrocketed. I don't know if you've seen the ratings lately and all that, but boy, thanks for joining me. And hopefully we're doing something right. And we're going to continue to do so to make you not only have you entertained, but give you some really good stock and mutual fund and investment tips. So again, it's episode 29. Just to give you some things we're going to talk about today, and then we'll go right into the show because we have a really great guest today. Someone who I've been chasing around for some time, actually trying to bring on the show for you. And her name is Liz Ann Saunders. And she is the chief investment strategist for Charles Schwab. And she has some great things to talk about because, well, I hope she will at least. I mean, I've talked to her before, but I think that we're going to probably get some good insight because I'm going to ask her about specific things concerning, you know, what's happening with the markets. And I really want to know about money markets and what the issue is there. So I if there's this whole aspect of a concern by her and other people in her position for the subprime exposure in money markets. We'll see what happens with that when I ask her. That's coming up in a couple of minutes, and we'll get right into that. Let me kind of tell you what's going on again for the new subscribers. Thank you so much for joining us today. You know, last week or so, I have been working on the audiobook. Many of you know that I have a book that just came out this week, The Disciplined Investor, and hopefully you've picked it up, and I'll tell you why you need to do so in a minute because it's going to be a kind of a follow-along play-at-home game we're going to do. But over the last week or so, I've been working on the book for Audible, the audio book for The Disciplined Investor. And it's kind of a tough thing because you really have to spend a lot of time focusing on the words that come across the screen. And the recording guys are kind of, gesturing at you and telling you what to do. At the same time, you're trying to make sure you don't make any mistakes with your words. Boy, is that tough. Try it sometime. It's not easy to read a book or any kind of long, wordy document out loud without making any mistakes, but it's been fun. Almost done. We should have it done in about a week or so, I guess. And then it's going to be available for download at Audible and I guess at Amazon and at iTunes, so that's going to be great. Okay, so let me tell you what's going on and tell you what I want you to look at to really understand what's going to be happening in the next number of weeks. We have a couple of great guests lined up like we always do, but we're going to also start doing what I planned on doing since the beginning when I started this podcast, which is to start going over the core disciplines of investing. And I've wrote this book so that I can really explain to you and show you how these core disciplines really work. And what we're going to do is go from the beginning on really how to and what is a discipline and how to develop it, all the way through the whole idea of quantitative investing and technical analysis and fundamental analysis. So it's kind of a combination of what we do here now, but also give you a really good education as to what it is that makes a quality investor successful and separate those from the investors that just do average out there. And what I want you to do, it's really important, I think, and it's not only just a sales pitch here, but it's important for you to get the book because I'm going to go over the key points, but you're not going to see maybe some of the other parts that really do some of the explanation around it. The book now is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and if you go to your local bookstore, if they don't have it, just tell them to order it for you. You can go to our website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and get it. But starting next week, we're going to go over chapter one, begin in the beginning, and we're going to talk about what is a discipline. We're going to talk about cost basis and understanding what is cost basis, what is a discipline, new definitions that you need to know about, and exactly kind of the core components of creating a highly successful portfolio. And we're going to do that a little bit each podcast in each episode and then go right through and continue on with our guests and market commentary, as well as I'll give you some tips and tell you how I establish them, et cetera, like I've always done. The second thing I want to talk to you about before we get into this interview today is that I'm going to be speaking in New York. I'll be at the Wealth Expo on, I believe it's Saturday, October 20th. And that's going to be taking place at the Jacob Javits Center. I'm going to be on at 4:30 in the afternoon at the Wealth Expo. And you can get tickets if you want. Go to our site and find them there, or just look up Wealth Expo in New York and you'll find it there. And then through the week, then when I'm in New York, I'm also going to be doing some book signings at Borders in Manhattan at the Wall Street branch, as well as the Penn Station and upstate and a couple of different places as well. So that's going to be fun. You can find the book, I mentioned this, but you can find the book now at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, etc. Also, I want to mention to you, so you know, this I want you to hear, There is a listener line that I've kind of been telling you about, but maybe you haven't heard me clearly because we had a few calls, but not that many. I expected a few more. And I think I get more emails, obviously, and we're going to read some of those at the end of this discussion today because I have one particular one that I want to share with you. If you have a question, you could either write askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com or you can call 877-623-8473. So if you didn't get that the first time, here it comes again, 877-623-8473. So with all that information out of the way, what we're going to do is we're going to make a quick turnaround here in the studio and we're going to link right in and get set up to talk to Liz Ann Saunders, who is the chief investment strategist of Charles Schwab. And I believe we're going to get some good information on what's going on and give some good advice on where to go, because you know where to find it. You know where to get it. It's on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Stick around for more of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
This podcast is proudly listed at podcastpickle.com.
In 3, 2, 1, and now back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, so as we said, we're here with Liz Ann Saunders, and thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Great. Let me ask you this. I think one of the things that's been on my mind, and with all the things that have gone on in the market, everybody's probably talking about recession and, you know, where are we going with interest rates. But what is the biggest problem that is facing, you know, the economy and markets right now, do you think?
Oh, I think it's the consumer side of the economy related to housing. And I think it's not only the subprime problems and the credit crunch that really, I think, permeated the markets and caused the increase in volatility for the most part in July and August. And we've seen a little bit of waning in that. But I think it's some of the longer term impacts that housing has. And I think that's the big unanswered question is how pervasive those problems are going to be and whether or not there are enough positive offsets to kind of cushion the blow from housing.
Yeah, because obviously the Fed is doing what they do best, is throwing money at a problem, which has been likened to the idea of just, you know, throwing candy at your kids when they're crying. And then where does that lead
us? Or opening up a bar across the street from a rehab center.
Good. It's interesting. But the whole idea of the housing market, this other issue that's really been weighing on me is how did we allow the lenders to lend to not only people who deservedly shouldn't have been lent to, but allowed to have this 125% or 120% no money down housing? I mean, how do we let that happen?
Well, that to me, I think, is the biggest problem. There's a lot of blame being put on the Federal Reserve for having kept interest rates at 1% too long. And you could certainly point to that as one of the problems that we're facing and dealing with the consequences now. But I think it was the very gross absence of any kind of legitimate oversight by the broad group of regulators, inclusive of the Fed, that could have seen this and probably could have at least done a little bit to prevent this from spiraling out of control. Now, of course, the regulatory blanket is coming out and being thrown across everybody, and it's a little bit of the barn door story. But that to me, the lack of oversight was what's most surprising in hindsight.
So, is the biggest concern right now the potential for a seizing up of the continuing, even though they allowed for some extra money in through infusion through the Fed open market intervention and the reduction of interest rates, is the biggest concern still that we may have a credit seizure?
Well, I think there's still very much that concern. You know, talking to people who are in the know, people in the banking system, other people on Wall Street, I think the reason why the Fed opted to do what they did with 50 basis points was probably not just in reaction to the volatility in financial markets, but as I hope most people know, their staff, Federal Reserve staff, as well as Treasury staff, spends an extraordinary amount of time, hours per day, on the phone with various representatives from the Wall Street community, from banks, who are undoubtedly telling them, look, this is truly a seizure and there's absolutely no lending going on. There's very little access to capital here. And I think that that's what they were reacting to. You know, time will only tell whether a renewal of some confidence here is sufficient to kind of get those wheels churning again. But I think the other problem is simply what is yet to come for the consumer. So it's not only the credit markets and the banking system, but the maybe more easy to understand and more simplistic aspect to economic growth that comes from the health of the consumer, which I think is still a big unanswered question. And I think still a lot of heavy risks coming down on those folks in the future.
I would tend to agree. How about this question? I was amazed when we saw that mid-July downstroke in the markets. And we saw this incredible correlation to oil moving down in price almost in reaction to it. And I said to myself, you know, how is that? Why are we seeing this all of a sudden? I don't think there's any change in supply or demand issues. And all of a sudden, when the markets turned around the other side, we see oil now hitting highs again. Is there any real correlation? Is it just happens to be at this point?
Well, there's a minor correlation between the fundamentals of supply and demand in oil. There should be a much tighter correlation between those two things. I think from a fundamental perspective, you could argue that the pop-up in oil that came following the move by the Fed as a result of the potential for the economy to get some juice back into it by virtue of lower interest rates. But if you look at things like the Commitment of Traders reports that looks at speculative positions in commodities, oil and all other commodities, there is no question that speculative positions have increased dramatically. So there's a lot of real fast, real speculative money that is moving very quickly in and out of these oil markets that are driving price swings in the very short term, well beyond what the long-term supply and demand fundamentals suggest. And I think it's something as an investor you have to be very wary of and mindful of, because there's a lot about this that is purely trading-oriented.
Yeah, the movement, the volatility of late, some of it was originally discussed maybe that some of the downside risk was associated to the removal of when you do shorting and the uptick rule in shorting. But then again, you got to think about if they really wanted to get around that, if you're a big firm, you buy on one side and then short it just to, you know, uptick it. But do you think that has anything to do with it?
I think in general, the removal of the uptick rule has added to some of the volatility, not just in commodities, but also in individual stocks. But, there's a lot more that's going on. Again, when you saw the production increase by OPEC, that in the past has meant a settling down in prices, and quite the opposite happened. So, it's kind of another proof point that there is there's a trading operation here right now that is just well beyond fundamentals.
Yeah. So, talking about OPEC and international, traditionally we have had and held on to in our country a strong dollar policy, and it's been something at least talked about and bantered about that's a good thing for us. Now, obviously, as we're seeing the consumers start to wane a bit in terms of buying habits in the domestic areas, we're real happy that our dollar is low because exports are just amazing right now, at least everywhere but to China comparatively. I think that Bernanke had this issue that he really was concerned about, that if he's reducing down rates, obviously it's going to have an effect on the dollar. I mean, where are we with this whole strong dollar policy that we've had for decades as a core fundamental of our economy?
Yeah, I mean, as a core fundamental of our economy, sure, and as a stated policy, sure, and you will hear Treasury secretaries, one after another, tell you that the policy is still there. What they say behind closed doors is probably very different, and there's no question in this environment now where the key underpinning to the U.S. economy being the consumer is under a lot of pressure right now, that we benefit from the 20% or so of GDP that is net exports, which mm-hmm. drives a huge benefit by virtue of the falling dollar. So I think right now, anyway, from a corporate profits perspective, from a GDP perspective, it's exactly what we want and need to see right now. The problem, of course, comes if the dollar's decline becomes less disorderly or more disorderly than it has been. Steady decline in the dollar for quite some time now, and we're pretty much at cycle lows. A pop up a bit today, but the dollar's been treading pretty steadily down since the turmoil erupted in the markets in the end of July. Net exports is again 18% of the economy, but the consumer is 70% of the economy. So the benefit can only go so far. I think if we were to have a more disorderly problem in the dollar, that would then probably kick up the speed at which foreigners are diversifying away from dollar-denominated securities. That's not a new story. It tends to be a new headline in the financial press, but it's been ongoing for about 2 years now. But that's been done in a fairly orderly fashion. That said, a pickup in that would be troubling. China, in fact, has been a net seller of U.S. treasuries for the last 3 months consecutively. That's a little bit troubling. They could certainly, if they had reason, a disorderly decline in the dollar or otherwise, could pick up the pace of that selling. Mm-hmm. So it is absolutely something we have to watch.
Yeah.
Orderly decline, good for corporate profits, good for the overall economy. Probably the administration and the Treasury Department are comfortable with that. Disorderly brings a whole nother set of risks into the equation, and I think watching what the dollar does is very important.
Yeah, I think that you mentioned a really good point, that the whole idea it's not a new headline. You know, nothing's a new headline really. What all we're seeing is a cycling of the exact wording of it. You know, the whole real estate boom is nothing different than we saw back in the 2000 technology boom. The issue now with subprime is no different than some of the things that we saw in terms of, you know, overspending and increasing of credit that we saw back in the early 80s. It's just a kind of a rotation right now. I guess we never learned our lesson, right?
Well, yeah, you think you've learned lessons, but you're absolutely right. What really we did, whether it's because of lack of oversight, as we already discussed, with the mortgage brokers, or keeping interest rates at a very low level for too long, we really just transferred the bubble from tech stocks into real estate. And the reason why I have pretty significant concerns about the overall economy, I'm not out saying that a recession is a foregone conclusion, but I think the risks of one are relatively high and have certainly increased in the last month or two, is when you think back at 2000 and remember what the commentary was prior to when it became obvious that this thing was a real problem for the overall economy, is people were saying this is relatively contained, this is just an internet overvaluation problem, this is not going to impact broader capital spending trends, et cetera, et cetera. So I find it hard to believe that if that little bubble, as was defined then in terms of the microcosm of the economy it represented, could eventually mushroom into a full-blown economic recession, it's hard to believe that housing, something arguably a little bit more broad in terms of its impact on the economy and how dramatically it's suffering, even more so in some ways than the internet stocks did or the internet companies' prospects did back in 2000, how you can look at that and say, you know what, limited impact on the overall economy. That's the lesson that I feel we may have forgotten, even if it's not a foregone conclusion that a recession is coming.
Right. I mean, the big issue also is, I think the last 2 years, the economy was really feeding on the increased housing values. And I don't think a lot of people understand that, you know, the fact was that the refinancing boom and taking money out of your house, utilizing lines of credit and all that, you know, while if done properly is not a problem, I think that a lot of people use it to excess. And that's, you know, nobody said, oh, well, this is a problem at this point. And it really, if you think about it, up until, what, May, nobody was saying there's a liquidity problem. Nobody was seeing anything. As a matter of fact, I saw
quite the opposite.
It was unbelievable, right?
You know, liquidity is booming. There's more than we could possibly use.
Shocking. I don't understand how nobody saw it. I really don't, because, you know, listen, I was 2 years ago saying, you know, real estate is way overvalued. Everything that I saw was getting to be a speculative bubble. Now, mind you, I had egg on my face for a year. Okay, I looked stupid.
Oh, well, hey, ditto. I wrote a piece last fall called Armed and Dangerous.
Right.
And I got a lot of criticism for being economically less than optimistic, given that I'm by nature a fairly optimistic person.
Yeah.
It was just the timing was maybe a little off.
Yeah, I hear you. Let me dumb this down for our listeners. We have a broad range, and not that anybody's dumb, but I have a question that I don't really totally understand. This month, Bloomberg Markets has a lead piece on the front page called Unsafe Havens. It talks about money markets, and that many money markets, unbeknownst to many individual investors, have a good amount of subprime debt involved in it. And the question then becomes, you know, what is the, you know, first of all, how do people find out about that? How do they find if their fund has, their cash money market fund has any subprime debt? And secondly, you know, what's going to happen there? It's obviously going to hurt somebody.
Well, you know, as far as how you find out, unless the holdings of the money market fund happen to be listed on the firm's website, which I don't know how prevalent that is, you know, it should be as easy as calling your financial institution and asking the question. I have a variety of money market accounts in various places and simply made the phone calls and very quickly was able to talk to somebody who gave me, you know, confirmation that there was little, if any, subprime exposure. So I think, you know, the phone call is absolutely the necessary thing to do and certainly the first place to start. I think what happened was that there was just a hunt for yield and there was the willingness on the part of these fund companies to maybe stretch out on the risk spectrum a little bit in order to pick up the additional yield. And herein lies the problem with the rating agencies too, which is being, another big kind of chapter to this story with the application of AAA ratings on a lot of these securities. Ultimately, it was proved that those ratings were a little bit lofty given what has happened in terms of delinquencies and defaults. And now we have the risk of a lot of those ratings being adjusted downward, which may further cause a lot of these money funds to have to liquidate those positions. So It really was just as we've seen across the board, which is just a hunt in a low yield world. A hunt in what was perceived to be at the time a low-risk way to pick up additional yield.
Right.
But not, you know, not all money funds are created equal. You know, Schwab's did not have exposure to subprime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you really do have to look at each one individually.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, but over the years, I've been in business doing money management for over 20 years, and the one thing that I've always stuck to was that any time that you chase yields, that you're going after something, whether it's in a fixed income environment of just bonds or it's real estate related or dividend related, every single time I've seen a yield chasing that was apparent by the masses, it led to a big problem.
You know what? You should never try to play offense with what is supposed to be the defensive portion of your portfolio. And I think that's what too many investors were doing.
Ah, that's a great line. I love that. That's a great line. That's something I think that is really interesting to think about, because I had somebody yesterday call me and says, why don't we put more money in the preferred stocks? And they were down, 3% over the last 3 weeks. I said, well, you know, because you were really concerned 2 days ago that they were down 3%. You know, now all of a sudden you want to invest
in
them.
Our rear view mirror
up.
Is a beautiful tool, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's the best. I love it. All right. Let me ask you this as we come to the conclusion of this. But what the average guy out there, average investor, the husband and wife that have, a nest egg and they're investing it themselves or they have a little help. What should they know now? What are you telling people in this market, which is nothing less than haywire?
You know what? I think that when volatility picks up, there's a couple things you have to remember. Number one, markets are volatile, particularly the stock market. In the absence of volatility that I suppose you could say we all enjoyed for the vast majority of this bull market, certainly from 2003 to 2007, was the exception, not the rule. And the increase in volatility is more the rule. So number one, welcome to the reality of investing in stocks. Number two, Understand if there's a big difference between your financial risk tolerance and your emotional risk tolerance. On paper, what we think our tolerance is for risk is probably a little bit more than what ultimately it will be when things start to get a little bit tougher. And then, most importantly, when you've gauged that emotional risk tolerance, then compare it to the risk you're taking in your portfolio, not after the fact, but an ongoing basis. And I think that's the mistake that investors make, is they make adjustments to their portfolio simply in reaction to what the market has already done, as opposed to on a regular basis looking for opportunities to rebalance. If you let your portfolio tell you when it's the time to trim an asset class back or add to an asset class, then you don't have to rely on your own forecast for the market, my forecast for the market, anybody's forecast for the market. It guarantees that on a regular basis, you're going to be, buying into weakness and trimming into strength. And it's just a healthy way to approach asset allocation.
It's kind of portfolio hygiene, right? Dental
Absolutely.
Hygiene. We brush our teeth hopefully once to twice or more a day, and then hopefully we don't get a cavity. But if we don't, we're in for a all sorts of periodontal and all sorts of work that needs to be done. Same thing with your portfolio. I say to people this. There's going to be times when they first meet with me. There's going to be times that you're going to love me. There's going to be times that you hate me. Just the way it is, And those times that you hate me, that you're really saying that SOB, that Horowitz guy, I want you to come up to my window with a giant brick or a rock and just before you throw it through my window, attach a $10,000 check to it and throw it, because that's probably the best time it is to invest. When we're really, not all the time, of course, but it stands to reason that when things get so frightening and people get so fearful that the markets are usually overdone, and the opposite is true too.
Absolutely. No question.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, thanks for joining me. It was Ann Saunders, Chief Investment Strategist for Charles Schwab and Company. I appreciate your time today.
Andrew, my pleasure.
All right. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This is Eric Savitz from Barron's Tech Trader Daily, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Did you know that bulls sometimes like the naked option? Bears sometimes buy butterflies, and diamonds are some trader's best friend. And there's nothing so satisfying as when we see our shorts come down. Unless, of course, everyone else has longs and are quickly covering their shorts. Did you ever see hammers with long bodies and short shadows after a shooting star appeared just prior to a dark cloud cover? There have been numerous sightings lately of long collars used upside down, head and shoulders. Sound like gibberish? Well, they're not. These are all real investment terms that you need to know. Learn the lingo and techniques of pro traders before you invest. And you too may even own spiders or even a new convertible. Coming to bookstores everywhere. The Disciplined Investor, the groundbreaking book that gives you professional investment tools page after page.
All right, I mentioned this before, but I want to make sure you heard me very clearly. Starting next episode, we're going to start going over the core disciplines, the key disciplines of the disciplined investor and of investing. And I want to make sure that you can play at home because I want to make sure that you get all the key components. Because when I talk about some of the components, I think it's important for you to have all the detail around it. So go get your copy of The Disciplined Investor. Go online at Amazon. Go online at Barnes & Noble, wherever you may go, and pick it up right now because during the next episode, I think you could follow along. We'll go through from the beginning exactly how to be a successful investor. All right, it's that time. It's time to dip into the mailbag. And you know, there's a couple of different ways to get in touch with me. Right on the blog at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, there's a place called Mailbox, and you can always write a note there and I'll get it, or just write at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also, you can, of course, call the listener line, which is a toll-free call at 877-623-8473. I get a lot of email, and I get a lot of questions. I do my best to answer them quite often and quite quickly. But this one really stuck out, and I thought I would read it to you. It's from a gentleman named Richard L. in he doesn't say where he is, actually. But nonetheless, he writes, hey, Andrew, I love your show. I'm trying to learn more about investing. Your blog and podcast are great. He says, I'll be ordering my book soon. That's good. He also says, I have one question about picking stocks that are very similar. The two that I'm looking at are Navtech and Garmin. They're in the same market, nearly same product, and they're very closely tied. When deciding between two companies like this, are there any strategies to consider? Thank you, and I appreciate your advice. Okay, that's a great question, because there how many times that we look at two stocks together on a comparison basis and try to figure out, all right, which one do I go with? All right, here's a couple of key factors. Number one, when we look at the two companies together, we have to look at, okay, who was first in, who was second in? Because oftentimes the second in, and think of Home Depot and Lowe's as an example, has a really good advantage moving forward, because what they do is they pick up on the strategy and the errors that were made by the first in, and usually do a really good job at saturating the market by really satisfying the customers with the issues that really are at hand. The second thing is that I look at the comparative ratios. So we look at the PE ratios, we look at the price book, we look at the price sales, and find out who is cheaper based on ratios. And finally, when I look at the stocks and how they've actually traded, I look at technical analysis, and we look at, okay, when we see these two stocks together, which one is having a greater amount of push and volume? So when we look at these stocks, obviously, oftentimes you find one is more of an investor favorite than the other, and you can really sense which one's going to move. And you see that in many stocks. I'll give you an example of a somewhat similar. You look like an Apple and a Microsoft. I mean, you know, both are operating systems. Both have similar general product lines. One is liked and one isn't. You pick out which one that is. And there's other examples of that all over the place. Finally, I think the main thing that we look at is who has the products that are continuing to saturate the markets. And we can find that out by the continuation of earnings growth. Earnings growth is going to be the biggest driver of this whole concept, because you want to look at the earnings growth comparison between the two companies. And when you do so, you find the one that has the greatest momentum. That's the one you're going to probably pick after all the other things that you look at. Most of this can be found at the Microsoft Money site. I really do like that site, but there's plenty of other places like Yahoo or Google that you can look at, Google Finance. But I think that's the best place to look, and I think that hopefully will answer your question. If you do have a question, again, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's going to be wrapping it up for today, folks. We're going to come back, and like I said, in our next episode, we're going to start working on the disciplines. Make sure you get your book, because it's going to be like a workbook for you to work with, and you know, make sure that you have your portfolio straight. Thanks so much for the comments on iTunes. Thanks for being there. Thanks for subscribing. I wish you a great week of investing. I'll see you real soon. This is Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.
Hey, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be here next time. Keep the emails coming in, and be sure to subscribe.